We're greatly appreciative of your presence here this morning. We're delighted to see you. As Greg has already pointed out, it is your job to listen attentively and carefully and with great scrutiny to everything I say. All I'm asking for is a hearing, and if you, in giving that hearing, find that I'm mistaken in some way or misstated something or have left a wrong impression, I would count you, my friend, for letting me know about that. On the other hand, if what I've said is true, all of us are in the same boat. All of us have to follow the same standard. I'm talking to me as well as to everyone else. Now, Carl was kind enough to say after the preaching this morning, some of you will say after the meddling, because I've stopped preaching and started meddling for these past few weeks, I want to talk about dressed to kill. I think that's probably self-explanatory. Several years ago, I watched a family, godly parents, raise their children, modest children, very godly in every way. And I watched in horror after some years, their one of their girls who had always been noted for her modesty began to be very, very immodest in her dress. And I thought to myself, what went wrong, what happened, and what can be done about it? And to the credit of the Lord and to her honesty of heart, she did change. I'm grateful for that. But those stories don't always end like that. Peer pressure is a very powerful thing. It's hard to stand when everybody else is against you. And it's hard to stand when everybody else is ridiculing you because of your stand, even in the way you dress, not just what you say or what you think. And when people think you're foolish and you're able to stand anyway, that is very commendable. And there's no place that better manifests itself than it does with reference to dress. Now, God imposes a standard of conduct upon us. That cannot be denied. What we find is this. If there is no standard for our conduct in any way, anything goes. It's a jungle out there. If there is no standard, what's wrong with rape, rioting, looting, stealing, murder, you name it? Somebody says, well, that's wrong. If it's wrong, you have to have some basis, some standard upon which to judge that as wrong. If there's no standard, you have no such basis. Furthermore, everyone believes in some standard. Everybody believes in some standard. If you don't believe it, go to the prison and talk to the prisoners. So these are the men you would assume in any society don't have any standard at all. Oh, but they do. Because when something happens in that prison that violates what they call their rights, they're the ones who are going to shout about it the loudest. They're going to get lawyers to come in, try to get them out of the predicament they're in. This is not right to treat someone this way. I never harmed anyone. What about those people you kill? Well, that was different. But you don't have any right to treat me like this here. And they're appealing to a standard there. Jeremiah 10:23, one of the most well-known passages in the Old Testament, whose principles run like a thread through old and new, says this, O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps. And that tells us two things. There is a standard, and that standard is not us. He says, it is not in himself, that is the way of man. He said, it is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. Now, the people who are in prison have been there because that's what they've been doing. They may agree there's a God, they may agree there's a standard, but they're living another way. And then further, in John 12, verse 48, Jesus makes this very plain. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I've spoken will judge him in the last day. Notice how he connects the me with my words. The me and the my, that's Christ. And it's me, you reject my words. To reject the one is to reject the other. And so that shows us the standard is not in us, it's not in man who walks to direct his steps, but there's someone else directing us, that's the Lord, and we learn of that direction through the words he's given us. Let's go a little further. Not only does God impose a standard of conduct upon us, his standard does not specify every sin. There are many occasions where God will speak in generic terms without specifying everything he wants, and he expects us to have the mind to figure that out. For example, he expects us to know certain things without explicitly stating them or without elaborating upon them. In Matthew 10:16, we're to be as wise as serpents, but harmless as doves. What does that mean? How wise is a serpent? And if I'm as wise as a serpent, what will that entail in my life? And at the same time that I'm as wise as that serpent, I don't have any of the harmful nature of that serpent. I'm to be as harmless as a dove. Nobody's scared of a dove. What does he mean by this? I think we have the ability to figure out how wise we're to be and how harmless. And part of it is not only looking at how Jesus lived and his disciples lived and what he told them to do, but in other passages that discuss these things. Hebrews 5 that we had on the board a moment ago tells us that there is a way for us to grow so that we can understand even those things that aren't explicitly spelled out for us. And he mentions those here. The Hebrew writer here is scolding those who haven't grown. They haven't matured as they should have. In verse 11, he says, we have much to say about this Melchizedek, but he says, it's hard to get through to you because you're so dull of hearing. You're still so immature. You're not able to grasp. You'll go away and say, what did he talk about? That preacher was over my head. And so in verse 12, for though by this time you ought to be teachers. See, there's a period of time in which this growth allows maturity. We might put it like this. Maturity enlightens careful students. That's what he means here. When for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that someone teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you've come to need milk and not solid food. Babies need milk. They can't handle a steak. When you should be eating steak, you're still with a baby bottle. That's what he's saying. Then in verse 13, for everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age, that is, those who by reason of use, they're using the information they already have to gain more. They're shining the light where they are, and if they keep following that light, they'll be farther down the road as they continue to mature. Those who are of full age, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern, to tell the difference between, to see what's right and wrong and good and bad, to discern both good and evil. Here are moral issues. What is good and what is evil? Well, Lord, why don't you just spell it out for us in every way? No, he gives us principles. And this is one passage of several that mentions this fact. In Romans 14:23, instead of seeing how close we can get to sin, the attitude of the Christian is to stay away from anything that might be wrong. Romans 14, at verse 22. Do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. But he who doubts is condemned if he eats. Now, let's pause. He's eating something here that's innocent in itself, but it's his scruple. It's his convicted conscience. He shouldn't be eating this. He shouldn't be drinking this Dr. Pepper. Shouldn't be drinking this coffee. But he does it anyway. If he who doubts is condemned if he eats because he does not eat from faith, well, whatever is not from faith is sin. Instead of seeing how close you can get to sin, this man, if he goes ahead and eats, is training his heart to sin. It's training his heart to do what he believes is wrong. And when you do that, there's no stopping place and there's no standard that's going to stop you from committing actual sin. A little earlier in this same chapter, in Romans 14, verse 13. Therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. Even if it's something we know is harmless, this brother believes it's wrong to drink coffee or wrong to drink a Dr. Pepper, and I have him over and I set it in front of him. I know it's not wrong, but he doesn't. I can't murder a brother, even if the thing he's doing is innocent, because his conscience alone will convict him. Now, should you follow your conscience? Yes. Does that alone save you? Absolutely not. Look at Saul of Tarsus. But you should never violate your conscience. That's a universal. You can't violate your conscience. Now, that doesn't make you right always. But you can't violate it and be right. Now, the third thing here, God's standard includes principles of mighty stress. And really, this doesn't have to be established very hard. It's pretty plain for us. Starting very early on. Let's go to Genesis chapter 3, if you don't mind. In this passage, the fall has occurred. Genesis 3 is one of the five major passages in the Old Testament showing the fall of man, and nothing is going to be the same from this chapter on. In this chapter, in verse 6, the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise. And she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. You may have a footnote there, and some of the other versions go along with this, that it's some sort of a loincloth, apparently, in its size and the amount covered. But however that may be, down in verse 10, God is calling to Adam, and he says, where are you? Verse 10, he said, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat? See, he had a standard, but he didn't follow it. He listened to his wife instead of to his Lord. She listened to a talking snake instead of to the Lord. It's amazing what people will do instead of listening to the Lord. Not much has changed from Genesis 3 till now. Then in verse 21, God is not satisfied with their attempt to cover their nakedness. What he does in verse 21 is to make tunics of skin, and he clothed them. Verse 21 here teaches us a couple of things that God doesn't want. He doesn't want nakedness. He doesn't want us to walk around in public naked, even at a time when it's only this man and woman. They're not to be trained that way, apparently. And then number two, he doesn't want immodest dress. Even after they make some attempt to cover their nakedness, it's not enough. It's not good enough. He gives them something else. This something else he gives them in verse 21 in this New King James is called tunics. That's a long shirt-like garment, undergarment. It's worn under the other typical ephods and robes and things. Generally with sleeves, reaching the knees, rarely the ankles. It'll go almost to the ankles in many occasions. You see this if you turn over a few pages. Don't lose your place in Genesis 3, I suppose. But in Genesis 37, you'll see in verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was a son of his old age, and he made him a tunic, there's our word, a tunic of many colors. Now, I'm not going to turn there, but you see the same word used in 2 Samuel 13, verses 18 and 19. This is on the occasion where Amnon, the son of David, rapes and misuses Tamar, the sister of Absalom, one of the daughters of David. And it tells her that she had on this kind of garment that the king's children wore. It was typically with sleeves, and it was typically down almost to the ankles. More about that in just a moment. And then another occasion where this occurs is Exodus 28. When God is speaking about the priests and what they're to wear. In verse 4 of Exodus 28, these are the garments which they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod that would cover basically the torso, a robe that would go down many times to the ankles, a skillfully woven tunic. That's the same thing as the coat of many colors of Genesis 37 and what Tamar wore in 2 Samuel 13. Same word in all these cases. Now, this is a relief, a bas relief, you'll see, that was made of the Assyrians in their capture of Lachish. And it's a little misleading the way I put this, but not really when I get to the explanation for it. The Israelite tunics illustrated. Here are Assyrians, here are Israelites after they've been conquered at Lachish. This is the first examples we have of number one news appearing up with their cameras. Instead of a camera, they would carve it into some kind of rock, typically. And the Assyrians were very impressed by their ability to capture people. So here's Lachish, and they come. And you'll notice these are not tunics because the tunics are worn under. But you'll see here are the ankles right about here, and it's up just barely above those ankles. And that just gives us an illustration of why those who write these dictionaries know pretty much what they wore in those days. And it goes back here many hundreds of years after Genesis 3, but it's still basically this same thing. And then the tunic will be under this, very similar to what we've already seen. Now, in Exodus 20, verse 26, these priests that we've talked about have to be very careful not to let someone look under their garments. Exodus 20, at verse 26, you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed upon it. Now, they're fully clothed. But it may be possible as they're walking up that they have loose robes that would let it be seen, some of their legs as they walk up. And so he says, make sure that doesn't happen. You don't have steps going up to this altar. And later he would talk about what the old King James called breeches that they would put on under these garments. But you'll notice here, the Canaanite worship involved a lot of sexual perversity. A lot of sexual perversity. There are scads of issues and evidences that are for that claim. But Israel is so far away from that, God says, you're not even going to have steps going up to your altar lest someone would see some glimpse of your leg as you go up. Quite a different standard. And so what happens in Canaan is not what God was approving of any more than what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. That wasn't what he approved of. He had to increase the size of the garment for them. Now, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 Timothy 2 gives one of the very clear and strong statements of the New Testament on this same issue. 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10. In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now, one thing you'll notice, if you're sitting there with any version different from what I have here, the difference of the words here. There'll be a wide variety of translations of these four or five words that we'll be looking at. The first one is apparel, literally alluring. They had a word that meant just something you put on. Then this is an intensive form of that means something you put on and it hangs down. So it kind of reminds you of the tunic in the way that he's describing it. And then he talks about the word modest. Now, this is interesting to me. These words, as we've talked about, you have a wide variety of translations talking about them. If you look at the New King James, this word modest apparel, then propriety, then moderation, you could actually translate all three of those as modest. Every single one of them in the dictionaries include modest or with modesty as their definition. So every one of these could be. So the scholars have to differentiate lest they say, let her wear this apparel that's modest, modest, modest. That'd be very emphatic, but he's using it emphatically with different words. I hope I've stated that clearly. This means basically well-arranged or seemly. Now, this is not what you typically think of when your clothing is well-arranged or seemly. Janet's always having to tell me, now, that's out of place, or you shouldn't wear that color with this, or this doesn't go with that. You can't wear plaids with stripes, although here lately I've been vindicated in that. They're doing it. But that's what most people mean when they talk about well-arranged and seemly. But God is not talking about the colors or the stripes and all this kind of stuff that fashion gurus speak of. He's talking about someone in verse 10 who professes godliness. And the colors are not the issue. The stripes are not the issue. It's whether it's modest. Will this clothing match this profession? That's the matching that's being done here. That's what's well arranged and seemly. It is unseemly for someone who professes to be a child of God, following and pursuing godliness. It's unseemly and out of place for that person to dress like a harlot, or almost like a harlot. Then you go a little further. Some people in the ancient world, in order to increase their appeal, people today would call it sex appeal, and their various garments, the Greeks and Romans wore tunics too, but typically much higher than the Hebrews would, and they would oftentimes slit the side of their tunics to show their thighs. They call them thigh showers. Phainomaritis, they call them. And they wanted them to be able to attract attention by a simple slit that exposed the thighs, thigh showers. Shamefastness is a word that was in the old King James, which is really a very, very good word because it gets right to the heart, to the attitude that you have to have in order to be this modest person. The modest person is not just someone who dresses properly but inside wishes he or she could do something else. No, it starts with the mind. It starts with the heart. It means shame, modesty, the capacity to feel ashamed if you act wrongly to others, hence respect for others and their rights. Now, it contains an element of fear. Shamefastness is based on fear. Men behave well through fear of what others may think of them if they do not. The reason a man is able to stand on the front line when people are shooting at him and he doesn't turn and run is because he knows what others are going to say about him if he does. So he summons up his courage, he gets the grit he needs, and he does his duty. Even if he's going to kill him, he's going to do his duty rather than run. Homer, in his Iliad and Odyssey, would use this very word to refer to heroes who must not lose face. The worst thing you could do if you were a soldier in the ancient world is lose face. There was an occasion at the Battle of Thermopylae that Herodotus describes when a couple of the Spartans weren't killed with the others. And one man was so distraught because he hadn't been killed, he just killed himself. The thought of losing face was so strong that they couldn't live with it. That's the word that is used. It's a very strong word. This modesty is fast. We talk about shame fast. Now, fast doesn't always mean quick. It can be an adjective or an adverb, but they're so closely alike, I can hardly distinguish between those two uses. We talk about someone who is bedfast. What does it mean? He has the fastest bed in the nursing home? It means he is stuck in bed. He is fast to his bed. He can't get out. If someone is steadfast, he is fast or stuck to his determination to do this job. He's not going to give up. He's going to keep on enduring. And someone who is fast asleep doesn't mean he can fall asleep faster than anybody else. It means he's out of it. He's thoroughly asleep. He's soundly asleep. We talk about people who are fast friends. These aren't runners or race car drivers. They're fast friends in that they're bound together. They're thoroughly friends. They're the best of friends. And on we could go with this. Now, if you're shamefast, you are so stuck and wedded to the idea of shame, this idea of losing face, this idea of letting God down, and humiliating yourself and what you profess to be, you're not going to dare go out in public in something that you shouldn't be wearing. That's the idea. Very, very strong word. It carries the idea of bashfulness. Almost a lost art in modern society. At a time when everything is in your face and this boldness and this impudence that determines to have this shock effect on people, bashfulness would be very welcome to those who are children of God. In Jeremiah chapter 6, one of the passages that is so clear on this subject, it covers so many bases, is Jeremiah 6:15. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Imagine what was going through the children of Israel's mind as they were doing all these things, not only idolatry, but all that went along with it. Just a bashed disregard for anything that's holy. Were they ashamed? No, they were not at all ashamed, nor did they know how to blush. You can become desensitized to blushing by the constant practice of what used to cause blushing, but now no longer does. Could they blush? This word, and I won't take the time to go there at this point, but you can note these down. It means to be humiliated, to be disgraced. It's the word that's used in 2 Samuel 10, verse 5, when David sends a couple of ambassadors to the king of Ammon. His father's just died, and he had shown David some kindness, and David wanted to go and just show some condolence. Some people got with that king and they said, "Do you think these people are really here to show you condolences? They're here to spy out our land. They've heard that the king is gone and you're this new whippersnapper and you don't know anything. They're getting ready to attack you." So these Ammonites, on wrong information, go up and they shave half their beards off. Then they cut their garments off, it says, up to their buttocks. And you talk about shame. These men had to go to another city, to Jericho, let their beards grow and get some decent clothes. They were so humiliated, so disgraced, they couldn't go into public like this. Oh, that would become the norm for American society today. I wouldn't be caught dead in that out in public. Oh, a lot of people are caught very alive with it in public. Philippians 3:19 tells us the attitude, and it's not a new one because Paul was seeing it in his day. He's writing in Philippians 3 about things that he's really, really bothered about. He calls these people enemies of the cross of Christ in verse 18. In verse 19, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly. Now listen to this. And whose glory is in their shame. These people are truly out of the closet. They're bragging about things they once hid. And they're glorying in things they should be so embarrassed about they wouldn't want anybody to know. No wonder in verse 18 Paul says, I write to this to you even weeping. I'm weeping as I write these words, implying this may be some Christians who are participating in this. Here's a summary. Shamefastness is restraint, a modesty that keeps one from excess. Adam and Eve cover themselves out of modesty, Josephus said. I thought an interesting comment. Well, maybe, but they cover themselves because God had a sense of modesty and he had to teach it to them. And then it is also a fear that keeps one from committing an unworthy act or a base deed. Now, in Genesis 41, Joseph has been in prison in Egypt for who knows how long. In Genesis 41, they come and get him. The chief butler's finally remembered. Here's someone who can reveal dreams. He's done it in prison. They come get him. But what do they do first? Genesis 41:14. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh. You don't show up in front of the king wearing your regular prison garb. Now, in verse 42, after he gets through interpreting the dreams for Pharaoh, Pharaoh says, I've set you over all the land of Egypt. Verse 42, Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. Here's a man who has two changes of clothes in one chapter. He's been in his prison garb. You can't show up before the king like that. That's disrespectful. They give him a bathing, put him in proper clothes to see the king. Now he's like a regular citizen in front of the king. Once he gets before the king, he interprets his dreams, and the king says, you're going to work for me. You're going to be second in command in the land of Egypt. No ordinary clothes will do there. You're going to dress as my second in command ought to dress. That's what he does, even to the point of the chariot which he drove. In Isaiah 6, I won't belabor this point, and I don't want to be misunderstood on this point either. In Isaiah 6, we have the famous scene after the king Uzziah has died, that Isaiah sees the Lord sitting on his throne, and verse 2 tells us above it stood seraphim. I take that to be a special kind of angel. Seraphim are very much like the creatures seen in Ezekiel 1 and Ezekiel 10 that are called the cherubim. Cherub is singular. Cherubim means plural, so it's more than one. Here's seraphim, plural. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. Now, interestingly, with two of these wings, he covers his face. As if to say, in the same way God said to Moses, Exodus 33, no one can look upon my face and live. Now, these are sinless creatures. They've never sinned. The angels that had sinned had been cast down to Tartarus. These are sinless creatures, but the dignity, the majesty of God is such that they will not look directly in his face. That's impressive to me. And then he goes a little further. With two of these wings, he covered his feet. Now, the word feet in many of these passages means more than just the things that go out like this at the bottom of your leg. It also means the lower extremities. For example, in Ezekiel 1, verse 7, speaking of the cherubim, their legs were straight. Now, the word legs there, you'll have a footnote in the New King James Version that will say the legs here means feet. It's the same word as feet. But their feet didn't cover just the toes to the heel, but all the way up. These creatures are covering their lower extremities in the presence of God. Now, am I saying that here's our standard for clothing? Now, you should have six pairs of wings, and you can fly with two, and then cover your face with one, then cover your lower extremities with the other. No. But I'm saying here's a case where this reverence and modesty go together. Their reverence for God is such they won't even look on His face, but they're also going to be so very modest, they're going to be covered. And that's the attitude of a child of God. Joseph didn't go in Genesis 41, and Pharaoh says, all right, let's get you some proper clothing to be my second in command. No, Pharaoh, that this is good enough. He doesn't argue with the king. And I guarantee you, these creatures, as high as they are and as sinless as they are, don't argue with the Lord. They're going to show Him the deference that is His due. And that's the only point I'm making out of this. That should be our attitude. Now, this other word, sobriety, in the New King James means self-restraint. Now, let's review just a minute. The negative word here is shamefast. It's not negative in a bad way. But it's focused more on the fear of disappointment, of losing face, of not being everything I should be. This word, sobriety here, is a positive word. It's rendering homage or deference to what is superior. Here's the fear of God, Kramer calls it. And this higher motivation is the basis for every bit of these other things he's saying. It's the same attitude as those seraphim in Isaiah chapter 6. Sobriety goes with godliness in verse 10. The one who professes godliness with good works, that's what she'll be clothed with. And that's the attitude we have in verse 2. Here's a worshiper of God. That's what we pray for in verse 2, that we'll be able to live a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness and honesty. That's what verse 10 says these women are professing. Now, people do judge us by our clothes. Like it or not, it is the truth. The old saying in ancient Rome was, clothes make the man. Well, they don't, but they certainly make impressions about the man. A widow. In Genesis 38, I find it impressive that Tamar, when she has been given Shelah, the third son of Judah, she took off her widow's garments. There were certain garments that would identify her as a widow. That's verse 14. In verse 19, so she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. So she puts on the garments of widowhood after having taken them off to have other garments. They show respect for God. God says to Moses, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Don't use dirty feet to walk on this. That's basically the idea of profaning a temple. The area pro the temple is the place where dirty feet walk, but inside is the holy. This is wherever God is, that's holy. A mourner in 2 Samuel 3, David said to Joab, he had just murdered Abner, tear your clothes, gird yourselves with sackcloth, and mourn for Abner. And of course, you know very well what happened in Jonah 3. Even the king set aside his robe and wore sackcloth, and he sat in ashes. It identifies a virgin in 2 Samuel 13, 18, one we referred to a while ago. She had on a robe of many colors, for the king's virgin daughters wore such apparel. The virgin daughters dressed like this, and it was very, very modest. There's a woman who's a harlot, Proverbs 7, verse 10. A woman met him with the attire of a harlot. I don't know exactly what kind of attire that was. But Judah knew. Solomon knew. The people of that day knew. And the people of this day pretty well know. And it identifies a child of a caring mother. She's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. Well, what a great mother these children have. It identifies a prisoner, Jeremiah 52, 33. Jehoiakim changed from his prison garments and ate bread regularly before the king all the days of his life. He's not going to dress like a prisoner in the presence of the king. It identifies where one lives, Matthew 11, 8. A man clothed in soft garments, is that what you expected in John? Those who wear soft clothing are in king's houses. It identified proper fashion. When the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who had not on a wedding garment. He said to him, friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment? He was speechless. He couldn't give an explanation. He was held accountable. He was thrown out, and there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. It shows false piety. In Matthew 23, 5, they make their phylacteries broad. The borders of their garments are very broad to draw attention to themselves. They enlarge the borders. It shows godly and ungodly character, which is proper for women professing godliness with good works, 1 Timothy 2:10. It shows whether you're rich or poor. If there comes into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, there comes in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one of the fine clothes, and you say to the poor man, you stand there or sit here at my footstool. Clothes Don't make the man, but they sure do identify the man. People judge us by our clothes. We have an annual, in this country, best and worst dressed awards. People notice what they wear. A Muslim woman boards a plane wearing her burqa and all the accoutrements of the Muslim religion, and people give a second look at her. The TSA doesn't. They examine the woman in the wheelchair. But these, yes, we look at them. Whoa, wonder what she has in mind. It may be perfectly harmless. A man enters a store with a hood and a mask. We automatically say, you know, something's just not right about his clothes. Right? We notice that. Carlite, true story. I was in Lewisburg, Tennessee. I couldn't turn my car off because if I had, it wouldn't have started again. The man knew that. As we were talking, I was about to buy another car. Onto the car lot drove this one of the worst, most beat up, dirtiest looking pickup trucks I've ever seen. It must have come over on the Mayflower. The man got out. He had on dirty overalls. He was unkempt. He walked over to a man, handed him something, and drove off. And the guy who ran the parking lot said, you know who this, the car lot said, you know who this was? That's the richest man in town. He's a multimillionaire. And he told me that. He had to tell me that because he didn't drive up in a Rolls Royce. You wouldn't have thought his clothes or his vehicle would have been driven by a man of that stature, would you? And this man talked about his wife who drove a Mercury Sable. She'd go pick up the children in this Mercury Sable. But all the while, for years, she was saving up to buy a Mercedes ML320. As soon as she started driving that car, all the mothers started coming to her, wanting to be her friend. They'd never noticed her before. But now, just as in James 2, they want to be friends of someone who drives something like this. People do notice. In Genesis 38, Tamar lays aside her widow's garments and she wraps herself. And that was thought to be the attire of a harlot on the part of Judah. Proverbs 7:10 says the same thing. And then there are T-shirts that are purposely offensive to Jesus. They'll have all kinds of comments on them. They're pure blasphemy. Now let's suppose a young man has just obeyed the gospel. He doesn't have any help from his family. He's just like I was, and like a lot of you probably were, just wet behind the ears, not knowing what he ought to be doing. And so he runs to the closet one Sunday morning, and he just grabs his T-shirt and puts it on, not even aware of what's on it, perhaps. Not even aware that he shouldn't even be owning such a shirt or wearing it anywhere. And he brings it, and they've just taught him how to wait on the table. And so in the assembly that morning here, he stands up and he has this comment on here, blaspheming Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. Are you uncomfortable with that? Now, we're not going to take that young man and slap him and say, don't you come back, obviously. There needs to be some training. But our point here is not the young man, it's the T-shirt. Does that bother you? Of course it bothers us. To ask it is to answer it, isn't it? In Matthew 22, this man shows up at the wedding feast. We just saw this. And he doesn't have on the proper garments. And the result is disastrous for him. Young lady that I was studying with, the very one I mentioned earlier, said, well, I wonder if this is not all just a matter of judgment. What you wear seems to be a matter of judgment. Well, let's just assume for a moment it's just a matter of judgment. Though we do have plain statements in 1 Timothy 2 and other places. Judgment often restricts and binds people. When you talk about the elders' qualifications are very clear. There's no give and take on what they mean. We know what they mean. The issue is, does this man possess these qualifications? And that's where some judgment has to come into play. And God knew it would be that way. You have to know not only these requirements, but this man and his character. Isn't that the case? There's a matter of judgment there, but it's still binding as a part of God's plan. The same thing in withdrawing from somebody. Part of the withdrawing is someone who's covetous. 1 Corinthians 5, 9 and 10. Have you ever heard someone being withdrawn from for covetousness? Well, I think so. If he gets so involved in his work and in possessions, he quits coming. That's basically what you're doing. But how do you determine when a person is sufficiently covetous to warrant a withdrawal? Is this person who just bought a new car and a new house covetous, but this person over here is not? Has it been on attitude? You can determine those things, basically, and that talking with people will help, and what they do will help, but it's still a matter of judgment at some point. Hebrews 5 shows us that these things are to be discerned by reason of use. And that's partly what this is talking about. Now, these are things that are very binding upon us, and yet they require some human judgment. So don't assume, well, what I wear, if it's shorts or whatever, that's a matter of judgment. Even if it is, there's a modesty issue involved. And that's the bottom line of all this. Now, there's a slippery slope also. To say this is just a matter of judgment implies in the mind of many people, well, you can do anything you want to. Well, what's forbidden then? Can you wear one piece of bathing suit? Maybe even in the assembly. How about a bikini? How about nothing? If it is just a matter of judgment, where is the stopping place on this slippery slope? It's not just a matter of judgment. Matthew 18, verse 6 is very plain, doing the same thing that Romans 14 is doing. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Here's someone who dresses immodestly, and it causes other people to lust. Now, in Matthew 5, he's addressed that issue. He's committing adultery in his heart. Well, I don't mean it that way. However you mean it, that's the effect. And it's causing someone to stumble. And also in Romans, again, in Romans 14, verse 15. Yet if your brother is grieved because of your food, you're no longer walking in love. Do not destroy. That word destroy, as in 1 Corinthians 8. Here's a person who loses his soul. He's lost. Here's a brother who can be lost. Do not destroy with your food. What a weapon to use to destroy a brother. Do not destroy with your food the one for whom Christ died. Now, if that's true of harmless food, what about? Do I need to make an application of the kind of dress that is designed to kill? Whether you mean it that way or not. A friend of mine went down to Brazil, lived there for several years, and one day he was eating with this woman. They couldn't communicate very well. It was before he had learned the language very efficiently, and she fed him something, and he got deathly sick, and he found out later she had fed him by mistake rat poison. She fed him rat poison. Now, she didn't mean to. So, why did he get sick if she didn't mean to? Well, what a question. Even if you don't mean to, you can kill someone by giving what the human body can't take. You can kill someone spiritually by giving that person something the soul cannot take. A young woman at MTSU years ago was asked why she wore such immodest dresses. And at that point, this gawker came by. She said, well, that's the reason. But suppose on that same campus you have a young lady who's a Christian. And she's dressing in the same way. And she says, well, I don't mean it that way. Do you think that gawker says, oh, well, she doesn't mean it, so I won't lust after her? It doesn't work that way, does it? Despite good intentions, you're still affecting someone else. My liberty ends where the other man's nose begins. That's a famous saying. You can't run into a crowded theater and yell fire. Well, I have my rights. I can yell anything I want to. You can yell it in jail if you want to. But no, you don't have the right to do anything you want to. And you can swing your fist all you want to, but when it meets somebody else's nose, now you've crossed a line. And so is it with immodest apparel. Well, I don't intentionally do this. Well, 1 Corinthians 9, Paul would forfeit his rights. Things he had the right to do. Even support. Eating of certain foods. Whatever it takes to save souls. Galatians 2, Peter leads the Jews and even Barnabas astray merely by the force of his example. Who is this man walking in the field to meet us? The servant said, it is my master. So she took a veil and covered herself. That's Rebecca. Upon meeting her soon-to-be husband, Isaac. Isn't it interesting that her reaction was to cover herself? Her first reaction, well, I'll cover myself. I don't think she was immodest before she covered herself. But notice this attitude. The veil here that she covered herself with, is a wrapper, a shawl that is a piece of clothing that covers the shoulders and the upper body of a woman, but in context could also cover the face. But moderns uncover to impress. She covered to impress him with a modest kind of woman, modest heart. The moderns uncover to impress. I want to impress people with my body. I want people to lust after my body. And others end up doing the same thing without having that intention. We've come a long way, haven't we? Now, I appreciate very much your very, very close hearing to these things. As I said, I'm asking for an honest consideration of these things. If I'm in error on anything, I can take whatever correction you want to offer. But if these things are true, and we realize that souls are at stake, how careful will we be in how we conduct ourselves, what we say, and how we dress? Thank you for your outstanding attention. Maybe someone in this audience has never put on Christ. You're all the sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. If you've not done that, you could come this morning believing in Him, the Christ, the Son of God. Repent of your sins. Confess Him accordingly. And be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. If that appeals to you and applies to you, we would be delighted to see your obedience. And if in any other way you're subject, won't you come as we stand to sing?